jury's like, oh, snap, a twist. Like, they love twists. Any great trial has a twist.
I suggest that we give him 10 years in Leavenworth or 11 years in Twelveworth.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take 5 and 10 in Woolworth.
Like this, Mr. Court.
I rest the judge, as Your Honor.
Well, it was like this, my honor.
Your honor, not my honor.
Why? Don't you like him?
You're meant to come down here and defend me against these characters, and the only one I've got on my side is the blood-sucking lawyer.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Argument... Have I ever messed that up?
And welcome to Arguments.
Have I ever messed that up? I don't know. Brian, let me know if I've ever messed that up. Hello and welcome to the show entitled Opening Arguments. How's it going?
I like the idea that you were maybe going to say hello and welcome to Argument Openings.
Yeah. Arguments, comma, opening the. Yeah, I don't know. That's weird. Okay. Anyway, I'm Thomas. How you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic now, Thomas. How are you?
Look, I was able to remember what our show is called for 300 episodes, and that's all my brain was willing to give me. It was like, yeah, do you really need to still know what this is called? It's 301 episodes. Come on.
And now Thomas can remember the name of the show, but he's forgotten how to tie his shoes.
So yeah. It's
going to crowd out some other piece of knowledge.
Okay. I'll wear flip-flops from now on. It's fine. Yeah. It's okay.
It's 115 outside. Okay.
I'm at the really fun, adventurous time of parenting where you have to try to explain to your toddler that shoes go on different feet. It's fun. It's cute. Like, and the thing about toddlers is, it's amazing. Humans really are born with an attitude that everyone is an idiot. Like, they know what's going on and no one else does. And it never goes away, I think, for some people. But, like, you're trying to explain, like, no, the shoes go on different feet. No, this is how it goes. Specifically on the opposite feet that they should be on. And then what do? You're like, oh, let me give you a counter argument. It's like, no, all right, fine. You just have to wear them wrong for a while, and then eventually,
maybe for 11 years.
Yeah. Hopefully within a few years, she'll figure it out.
Phoebe will be getting her learner's permit and, like, you know, look down and be like, it's really weird the way my left shoe bends to the... Oh.
Yeah. Oh, good times. All right. Well, while we're shooting the clown horn here, a little announcement update. Not very many seats, if any, left for that New York live show. Now, we record this in the far past, but as you're hearing this, there may be, but here's the thing. Jump on the wait list if you still want tickets, because there's every chance that you might get something available, or we'll see. There's some wiggle room in there for some, you know, from setup and seats and all that. So if you go to the Eventbrite thing and you see that it's sold out, jump on the wait list, because it's not for nothing. I'll just say that.
Yeah. We will take those seats in order if additional seating opens up, which might be, it could. And as of our recording of this, we have a small handful of VIP and platinum tickets left. I'm sorry, you got a wait list if you want the general admission ticket, but if you want the special extra bonus deluxe awesome stuff that comes with the VIP and platinum tickets, you may still be able to get one or two of those. So hop on that.
All right. And is there anything else before we get on to our show, Arguments?
Yeah, to further confuse people, I wanted to give people a little bit of a warning about this, because we were approached for a show that Thomas and I both listened to It's Sean Carroll's Mindscape. That's somebody, the physicist Sean Carroll, like he's somebody that's probably well known to many of you. And he is moving to another network. We were asked to do an RSS feed drop, right? So it will drop into the opening arguments feed. Now, we get asked to do this all the time. And every single time we've said no.
Yeah.
And you know, we don't want to intrude. This really, I mean, this is a show that both you and I, Thomas, that we've listened to like pretty much every episode. So that will be coming. If you don't want to listen, then you know, feel free to delete it out of your feed. We didn't want it to be a total shock. It does help out somebody that we think is a really, really great voice who's putting on a great show. So I did want to give kind of everybody a little bit of a heads up on that. And we, you know, let us know, if you find it not intrusive and a great way to get exposed to a new show, let us know that. If you think we should never, ever do that again and you hate us, let us know that too. Hopefully it's,
if you like our new show name arguments. No, also, if you're a patron, you don't have to worry about any of this. Don't sweat it.
That's true. You'll never notice.
Not for nothing.
But
that's a good heads up there. And now I think we should get on to our first segment here, which was somebody who I think has a very high opinion of themselves was interviewed by the House Intelligence Committee. And we're going to, because our first rapid response mainly dealt with just the first round, the first 3 hours of Mueller testimony. And now we're going to cover as much as we feel like it on the second 3 hours of Mueller testimony. So why don't we get into it? All right. So not sure what you want to talk about, Andrew. I did, you know, I love Schiff. I think he did just a stellar job all around. What were your thoughts on this?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, it sort of came out of the gate with Schiff asking the kinds of pointed questions. And I've heard a lot of analysts sort of trying to break this down. I don't think that the questions that Schiff asked were different in form from the questions that some of the good questioners asked on the House Judiciary panel, particularly Ted Lieu, for example, right? Short, pointed, yes or no questions, not complicated amounts of going back and getting and getting Mueller's testimony. I think the difference was that Mueller is much more comfortable testifying before the Intelligence Committee, and I think that reflects his career in public service, right? It reflects, right? Like he was very, very. It is clear to me from watching, you know, what we said on the bonus show that dropped early. It's clear to me that Mueller thinks that President Trump committed numerous crimes, and that Mueller thinks that impeachment is appropriate. But also, he does not want to be Robert Mueller got Donald Trump impeached for whatever reason, right?
Yeah.
Like he is terrified of being that guy. And I think it is because he would not mind being Robert Mueller is the guy that sounded the alarm as loud as possible about the fact that the Russians are interfering in our elections. So, you know, open-ended questions that would have gotten an I don't want to comment on that, got comments in the Intel Committee.
Right? I wonder if they're feeding him steady drinks going along. He loosened up. You know, he had a few beers after the first one.
was definitely a three martini lunch at the
But Poland I forgot we need to start at the most important thing, which was his correction. So he opens up the thing. He says, "Hi, I just want to issue a correction. I accidentally said something useful in the first 3 hours, and I wanted to correct that. I should have said nothing useful." So are we all?
And I don't. I think that walk back. I mean, I think we analyzed it correctly. This was to the terminal question that Ted Lieu asked, and what Mueller was saying was, I did not mean to say that we had reached a decision to prosecute, but didn't go forward only because of the OLC opinion. Rather, what I meant to say was, we did not reach a decision because of the OLC opinion.
It wasn't it even worse. It's like we didn't reach a decision on reaching a decision. Like, we decided not to do any decisions because of the OLC opinion, which to me just further illustrated how frustrating this whole thing is. Like, I don't really get how this was supposed to work. You know, do you, question for you, Mr. Torres, do you think there is a good, coherent, I don't know, plan or rule of how this thing was supposed to happen? Or do you think that Mueller had in his mind one thing and Barr and others had in their mind another thing, and it's not really cohesive and it's just kind of whatever, and it's not very effective in the end? There's no like bird's eye, you know, like designed view of how this process is supposed to go, it feels to me.
I think that's a really, that's an excellent observation, right? So look, there was clearly some level of coordination, particularly among the junior Congress, the junior members of Congress on the Intelligence Committee, right? That asked questions that they weren't really smart about listening and asking follow-up questions. You could have done that. That's not a hard thing to do. Most of you are lawyers. That was kind of disappointing. But in their pre-written questions, they definitely had, you know, it evidenced a level of coordination that I thought was, you know, reasonably effective given the circumstances.
Right. I was referring to the process of the special investigation itself.
Oh, yeah. So I'll get to that in a second. Okay. But what I wanted to say was, with respect to the thing that made this different, is it was very clear to me that there was very little pre-testimony work between Mueller and the House Democrats, right? Hmm. Everything that we'd been told about him being a reluctant witness was on full display here. And you know, I've had cases like this where a witness who is on my client's side is sort of only nominally on my client's side. And every time, and I'm like, hey, why don't we get together for 8 hours before your deposition? And he'll be like, well, why don't we get together for breakfast the morning of, which that literally has happened to me before. And it's like, okay, well, you know, so we're going in with 20 minutes of prep instead of 8 hours. You're not going to do great. And they don't do great.
There are people I know to where if I had to be a witness for them, I'd be like, I'm not. Yeah. Breakfast. I'm not doing 8 hours. I don't care that much. is that what it is? Or is it like, what?
Yeah, no, seriously. It is often that, right? Like, so think about it in the business tort context, right? Which the cases that I litigate, you know, when a key witness is a former employee, like if they're a former employee who left on bad terms, then, you know, just forget it. But even when it's a former employee who's left on good terms, they're like, yeah, I mean, I worked for this, you know, 11 years ago, and like, you know, I sell lighting fixtures now. Like, what do you want? And that happens. So, you know, that was very clearly on display. With respect to the overall investigation, I lean more in your direction, because I was leaning in the other direction earlier, right? And let me be clear with what I meant on that. Various individuals who were a part of the Mueller investigation, who resisted subpoenas or filed pleadings to try and declare that the Mueller investigation was constitutionally or legally infirm, right? Including Roger Stone and Jerome Corsi and Carter Page, not Carter Page. The name is not coming to me, but folks litigated this issue. And one of the things that came out, right, and said, you know, this exceeds Mueller's authority. Well, yeah, Manafort made these arguments too, I should say. All of these people litigated these issues. And one of the things that was submitted in evidence in all of those cases was a memorandum from Rod Rosenstein to Robert Mueller confirming the extent of his authority to handle all ancillary cases that came up as a result of the investigation, right? That was heavily redacted. We still have not seen an unredacted version of that. It might be a good FOIA request now to say, hey, we need to see an unredacted version of this memo now that the investigation's over. That's Maybe we'll file one. But I know we have journalists that listen to the show. So, you know, if you are, consider going to Judge Beryl Howell and asking if she will declassify the internal Rosenstein to Mueller memorandum. In any event, my point on that is I certainly thought a year ago that there was much more direct coordination between the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and Robert Mueller with respect to how this investigation was proceeding. And that may well have been the case. And then when Rosenstein left, you know, Barr just wrecked all the infrastructure. That wouldn't surprise me. Or it may be that I misread that situation. But I definitely agree with you. This is the longest winded way possible of saying I think you're exactly right, that there was no sort of top down coordination. And again, that kind of creates another point of disanalogy with the Ken Starr proceedings, where he was in back channel contact with Newt Gingrich every single day, right? He was the attack dog out there pursuing whatever he could find in a coordinated fashion to make the best attack brief that he could, which is what the Starr report is. So, we had nothing like that.
I guess I'm still big picture in all this stuff. What was so frustrating about that we're not deciding to even decide is I get that you're saying, or that, you know, Mueller, whoever is like, well, because of this OLC memo, we can't indict the president. Okay, fine. Let's go with that for fun. I don't. Why do we get to the part where they're like, well, we can't even say what we would have done if not for this memo? Why does it go that far? Wouldn't it be totally reasonable to say, all right, we can't indict the sitting president. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to prepare this whole report and this investigation as though this were a citizen. And then at the end, we're going to say, here's what we would have done if it's not the president. And then we got to hand it off because we can't indict a sitting president.
I want to be 100% clear on this. There is absolutely no legal reason why they could not have done that. There is no control, in my view, no strong ethical reason not to do that, right? In yesterday's show, we talked about the ethical constraints that Robert Mueller believes that he's under in terms of, you know, lack of cross-examination. But as I pointed out, and as I am certain that the very, very smart lawyers on Robert Mueller's team pointed out to him, this is the proper analogy here is to a grand jury. They are preparing an indictment. In no other case, right? If this is John Q. Smith, John Q. Smith does not get access to the DOJ's internal deliberations as to whether they're going to charge him or not, right? They just go to the grand jury, and either the grand jury returns with an indictment or they don't.
To bring my uncle John Q. Smith into this, but okay, sure, I get it. Next time, pick one of your family members.
John Q. Torres. There we go. That has a slightly different connotation in Trump's America. That's true. So.
No, that he's just guilty. Whoever that is guilty.
Yeah. So there's no reason that they couldn't have done that. I don't want to undercut. I think moving the needle with public opinion, right? Mueller's testimony in the second half before the Intel Committee delivered stronger lines, more passion, more engagement, more knowledge, you know, all of the stuff that is better to the public.
But I think it's really important. I know we've said it, but it's really important to remember that Robert Mueller is a Republican. Now, we can all picture our most principled Democrat that there is, and maybe it's Andrew Torres. Like, you're in there, you're super principled lawyer, Andrew Torres, and it's President, Hillary or something. Maybe it's Bill Clinton or something, you know, like, and you're going to do your job, you're going to try to be ethical, but are you going to go out of your way to get the Democratic president impeached? You know, like, are you going to... Or would you rather find every excuse in your mind to do what seems like is by the book, but also is as unhelpful as possible?
I think that's a good way of thinking about it. Right. And, you know, and it's easy to say if it were the Democratic equivalent of Trump, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we've said that, but truth be told, we've never been in that situation. I hope we never are in that situation. I think that's a good way to think about it.
Yeah. You know, although, as I said that, I'm already questioning if, let's say, it's President Avenatti.
Yeah. No,
I just get him out of there. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Who's the vice president? Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know, but it's a fair
important to think
experiment.
About.
Look, one other thing really, really struck me, and that was there was a tweet from Andrew Desiderio, who is a reporter with Politico, and his tweet said that this came out in the middle of Mueller's testimony before the Intel committee. He said, "Wow, Mueller says he didn't subpoena the president, quote, because of the necessity of expediting the investigation. The expectation was that Trump would fight the subpoena," Mueller said, "and that would drag out the investigation." And he thought that that was a bombshell. I'm not picking on Andrew here, right? He's a good reporter with Politico. I read his stuff. I read Politico. We cite there all the time, right? That testimony was not a bombshell. That was clearly set out in Appendix C of the Mueller report. It was explained by us on episode 271.
We read your stuff.
The least you can do is listen to our show.
Call that on the show before the report even came out?
No, that was the day the report came out.
Oh, the day of the report. That's right. Okay, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. And I went to Appendix C because that contained the president's answers to the written questions, right? And that has the paragraph at the end, is page C3, that says, "Recognizing that the president would not be interviewed voluntarily, we considered whether to subpoena his testimony. We viewed the written answers to be inadequate, but at that point, our investigation had made significant progress, weighing the costs of lengthy constitutional litigation delay against the anticipated benefits. We decided to go ahead." So that was clearly stated. My takeaway from that is, if Andrew Desiderio hasn't read the full Mueller report, right? And again, he's probably read all the text and he just, you know, skipped the appendices because that's fair, right? It's 480 pages long. I get that. 448 pages long, right? I get it. That really emphasizes the point you and I made heading into Mueller's testimony, which is, people haven't read this. And it is important. And the more that we just convey to the public what the report actually says, as opposed to what Bill Barr and Fox News says it says, the more progress we make. Is it enough progress? I don't know. But I feel like that is progress.
Yeah, I saw a good tweet that I should have thought of, which is, you know, for the Republicans, I can't remember the exact wording, but it's like, for the Republicans, the Mueller report is like the Bible. None of them have read it, but they insist they know what's in it, kind of thing. It's pretty much like that. You know, I got to ask you, because I've watched all this testimony and stuff, and I don't want to get, it's hard to get fully into the upside down world Republican view of things, you know, like it's almost, you'd have to, it's like moon landing stuff, like fake moon landing, like you have to get so into the ideology to even understand where the questions are coming from. They're throwing out references of people that you're like, I don't even know who that is. But one thing that I thought would be, and I don't know if you planned on covering this, but I thought would be worth dismantling here, is this. I think it's just the ranking member Nunes, who is the most colossal stooge. Isn't he a California representative, too? It just makes me want to.
Oh, yeah.
We can do better. We should be able. There's a lot of conservatives
California and New York need to pass laws re-gerrymandering the hell out of those two states. Like, you can make California 41-2 Democrat.
Let's
do
it, guys. Poor Schwarzenegger, after all his efforts to make gerrymandering more independent in California or whatever, or make it district line drawing more independent. But anyway, the point is, he had a thing about how, like, his whole thing is, there's no, is it the Department of Justice or is it the Department of Exonerations? Is there an exonerations office in the Department of Justice? You don't even have the power to exonerate because all your powers, Mr. Mueller, come from the Attorney General. And the Attorney General doesn't have the power to exonerate somebody. So what would it even mean to say that you did not exonerate Trump? Because you can't exonerate him. So ipso facto, the whole thing is a fraud or whatever.
That is like telling the janitor, you have the power to turn on the lights, but like, you've got no power to make blackness happen in the room. Like, you know, how could you possibly have darkness? Your job is the lights guy, right? Like that, exoneration is the phrase that Mueller is using so that he does not have to say, but for the fact that he's the president, he committed a crime. Also, I would point out that I don't think the party that has been chanting no collusion for a year and a half wants to get into what the precise legal definition of various terms are.
They did apparently want to get into that.
It goes to show you that if you are a fair-minded person, the minute, right? I mean, like this is, it's sort of like when you read the exchanges between, you know, evolutionary biologists and creationists, right? Like that they can both write stuff that, you know, if you're not particularly engaged, you're like, oh, okay, all right, I get bacterial flagellum, like whatever. But the second you scratched like a millimeter beneath the surface, right, on the one side you see science, and on the other side you see like the craziest, most contradictory, most quote mine nonsensical rationales, and like any reasonable person could sort of look at that and be like, oh, okay, like I see what's going on.
Well, but
here.
Sometimes
and,
it takes the expert to say that, though, you know, because it is complicated. And I think it's important, and let me know if I get any of this wrong, I think it's important to go through the logic of what Republicans think should happen here, because you've got a special investigation, right? And according to the Republicans, you don't have any power to indict the president. You apparently also don't have the power to exonerate the president, weirdly, I guess. And also, because of that, you should not be putting into the public sphere any sort of information one way or the other, because the president doesn't get a chance to respond or something. Like it's unethical because you can't, you know, exonerate them to that. That's their claim, that you can't put out the report that has all this embarrassing stuff. And also, by the way, you're not allowed to indict them. So what you should do is conduct an investigation, give it to nobody, and do nothing about it. Is that what it is?
Oh, no. So let me steel man the other side. Again, it's all you have to do is, right, replace, I'll steel man it first, and then we'll allow any reasonably bright elementary school kid to point out the fallacy. Yeah. They will say the special counsel, and you heard this rhetoric all day yesterday. They will say the special counsel statute is separate from the independent counsel statute, right? He is hired by the attorney general, or in this case, the deputy attorney general, because the attorney general recused himself, subject to specific authorization. And the report that the special counsel is required by law to produce must be turned over to his boss, the attorney general, right? So in other words, that Robert Mueller is 100% a contract employee of the Department of Justice, subject to the attorney general. You should have given the report to the attorney general, not released it to the public. And then it's up to Bill Barr to make the decisions. And Bill Barr said, nothing to see here, folks, move along. So now why are we even here? Why are we talking to
you? I hear you. But wouldn't they also further say that Bill Barr wouldn't have the power to indict the president or anything, right?
Correct. Bill Barr would not have the power to indict the president.
What would he even do with that? Like under the Republican. Yeah, exactly. So it's do an investigation, give it to a Republican hack who will then do nothing with it and show no one. And that's how justice works, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's right. And again, you don't have to, right? They will say, oh, well, you know, with Bill Clinton, like we had that independent counsel statute and gosh, it was just, you saw all the problems with the independent and it's just, we got rid of it. So thankfully we got rid of it. I'm sorry that, you know, Bill Clinton had to suffer through that. It's ridiculous. Yeah. There is no doubt in my mind if this were President Hillary, that the tables would be reversed. But
I'm going to do my best not to shout. But do you remember that Bill Clinton was on tarmac with the Attorney General, and that was seen as so inappropriate For what reason? I don't know. But yep. Okay, I'm going to do, I don't want to get my blood pressure up.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. Keeping it. Okay.
Stress ball.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Give it a real good squeeze.
It just popped. It blew up. There's some ink everywhere.
Oh, eyes bugged out. Yeah.
So, Andrew, what's this I hear about Nadler saying he can launch impeachment proceedings? Does that work?
So it depends on what the definition of it depends on what the definition of proceedings is, right? So this is a story that's making the rounds. It originated with a CNN journalist who said that Nadler apparently told a closed door session of Democratic lawmakers that he can launch impeachment proceedings. Here's what I think that means, right? So here's what it doesn't mean. Nadler can't begin the impeachment process, right? That requires a vote of the full House of Representatives. What he can do is he can file an impeachment inquiry. And in fact, he did that in 2017, even when he was the ranking minority member on the House Judiciary Committee. I'll link that in the show notes. The problem is that an impeachment inquiry, literally, you'll see this from the form, is just a request to the Attorney General to turn over documents, right? So, yes, you can do that. You can have other avenues, but I mean that the various House committees are already, I think, fully engaged and using, every weapon at their disposal to conduct oversight and to gain information. And, we know what Bill Barr's response to a polite letter directing, him to turn stuff over to the House Judiciary Committee is going to be. So it doesn't get you any further. But technically, I mean, it's called an impeachment inquiry. It's a resolution of inquiry. It's a kind of impeachment proceeding. That's what I think was overheard. So I know that this is kind of bubbling up through the liberal Twitter sphere, but it doesn't mean any more than that.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, look, you wouldn't want it to, right? Like, I would not want a single Republican member of the House of Representatives in 2021 to be able to initiate impeachment proceedings against Elizabeth Warren, right? Like, it's you don't want that. So, the system is bad and broken, and it feels like we should do everything we can, but this isn't one of the things that we can do.
All right. Well, I think we should take a quick break, and then we're going to get to some what Andrew's promised will be good news.
Yes.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by Vistaprint. When I went full-time on the podcast thingy, it was important to make sure that I was ready for opportunities to meet people at conferences or even just in everyday life when someone asks me what I do. It's kind of hard to explain sometimes. Well, letting them know that I'm professional, that I'm for real, that I actually do this for a living is a lot easier with brilliant looking business cards from Vistaprint. Ordering cards from Vistaprint let me feel like I could make that professional impression right in the moment. Your next big opportunity is coming right now, and all it takes to feel like you're ready to own the now is $10. That's a low price to have the confidence that you're always ready to make an impression or get seen in a new way. A custom card with the colors, fonts, designs, and images you choose means you can look and feel like a big deal whether you're a startup or a business with a century of history. And it doesn't have to be hard. With Vistaprint, you can create truly professional, unique cards in minutes. Upload your own design or start with one of our professionally designed options. Vistaprint offers simple tools and a wide range of templates to choose from. Pick the paper stock, the style, and the quantity that's right for you. Choose your delivery speed, order, and receive your cards in as few as 3 days. Vistaprint uses only carefully selected inks and responsibly sourced paper stocks. They have dozens of designs that are just right for your business. Add your logo, your contact information with just a few clicks, and know you can use it all on your marketing going forward. Your satisfaction is 100% guaranteed, or they'll make it right, either by reprinting your order or offering a refund. Vistaprint wants you to be able to own the now in any situation, which is why our listeners will get 500 high-quality custom business cards starting at $9.99. Just go to vistaprint.com/OA. That's Vistaprint.com/OA. One more time, that is Vistaprint.com/OA.
There will be days when we lose faith, days when our allies turn against us. But the day will never come that we forsake this planet and its people.
You are either lying or you're stupid!
I'm stupid! I'm stupid!
Good news, everyone! What is it?
you do a pretty good Farnsworth.
Tell us.
Okay, so a couple things. So, first, this is temporary good news coming out of Arkansas because this is the continuing battle of the right wing's war to overturn Roe v. Wade. Arkansas had passed three different anti-abortion bills. Bill 493, Act 493, essentially prohibited all abortions after 18 weeks, right? So considerably later than Alabama and Georgia, but still at a time that is well before fetal viability and represented a really severe restriction. They passed two other bills that are part of the ongoing effort to make it hard for doctors to provide abortions and women to get abortion, right? So one was a bill that said you can't provide abortion if there is a test that indicates that the baby has Down syndrome. Again, as far as I can tell, and I know we have people on different sides of the issue here, like medically selective abortions do not appear to be a thing in the United States. There does not appear to be any data supporting that. If I'm wrong on that, let me know. But as far as I can tell, it isn't. It wouldn't trouble me if it was, but as far as I can tell, it isn't. And the third bill, which is Act 700, requires that all physicians performing abortions be certified OBGYNs, that they must be board certified, board eligible in obstetrics and gynecology. That's a nonsense, right? There was absolutely no medical reason to do that. The reason to do that is to take abortion providers in the state and require them to spend tens of thousands of dollars or more in schooling and licensing and all sorts of unnecessary stuff so that it makes it harder to provide abortions in the state of Arkansas. So those three bills, we didn't cover them as part of the initial range of states losing their minds over abortion because, you know, compared to Alabama and Georgia, you know, that feels like Sweden. But nevertheless, those are restrictive and awful. And the good news is a U.S. District Court judge in Arkansas just issued an injunction blocking all three bills, blocking as again, we have predicted, right? The law is exceedingly clear that these kinds of restrictions are patently unconstitutional. In my view, the most significant aspect of this decision is the treatment of Act 493, because in that case, the judge said, we do not apply the Casey undue burden test. We don't ask whether it is an undue burden if a state attempts to prohibit abortion of a pre-viability fetus. And that I thought was a pretty radical is the wrong word, a pretty strong way of characterizing Casey. So what it says is you go through all the balancing tests. You figure out, is this an undue burden? Is it not an undue burden? When you have a restriction like information or like the certification or whatever. But, and here I'm just going to quote from the opinion, because 493 prohibits nearly all abortions before viability, it is unconstitutional under controlling precedent. The undue burden test does not apply. This act is far greater than a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman's choice. And the Supreme Court has clearly held that pre-viability abortions cannot, is a prohibition that cannot be imposed by the state. And then they point out this court is not alone in refusing to apply the undue burden standard when presented with state laws that unconditionally eliminate the right to abort a non-viable fetus for a defined class of women. This is an incredibly well-reasoned. It is 159 pages long. It is comprehensive. It is just a district court opinion. But like, you know, Kitzmiller v. Dover was just a district court opinion. This decision will be cited by other district courts around the country as they are dealing with these kinds of draconian abortion laws. And it's the law is enjoined for now, right? And I believe that every other law that we've discussed on the show that imposes these drastic restrictions on abortion is going to meet the same fate. So that's at least good news.
Until the Supreme Court says something, right?
Yeah, yeah. Look, the Supreme Court's going to have to deal with this. And, you know, when we've talked about it, and I've said that, you know, I think the really crafty John Roberts worst case outcome is, you know, he's going to craft some decision that purports to leave Roe and Casey intact while, you know, allowing drastic restrictions on a woman's right to choose. That's coming, and that's going to be bad, and there's nothing we can do about it. But, you know, we can try and develop a body of good law in the meantime.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe we'll get lucky with the Supreme Court, too. Who knows? Who knows?
Who
probably,
knows?
Probably not.
Yeah.
Is there more good news? Could we dare
there is
we
more
dream?
Good news. And this, I think, is good news that even has a possibility of surviving this Supreme Court.
Wow.
That is predicated on my view that the conservative majority on this Supreme Court is A, not personally beholden to Trump, which I don't think they are,
right.
And B, that they are conservative ideologues, but not fascist monsters, right?
Mm.
Which, again, I'm slightly less comfortable with that hypothesis.
Yeah, I was going to say, that one a little...
I'm reasonably comfortable with that hypothesis. The only people, right, because look, they're on the Supreme Court for life. I find it hard to imagine that Brett Kavanaugh is cackling with delight over the plight of children being ripped from their parents at the border and being thrown in cages. I think the only people that care about that are you know, Donald Trump and his
Stephen
band
Miller
of supporters.
Yeah.
So what happened last week, actually week and a half ago now, July 16th, 2019, the Department of Justice and the Department of Health and Human Services published a joint interim final rule entitled Asylum Eligibility and Procedural Modifications. We got asked about this and I said, hey, we're going to cover this as soon as the injunction is handed down. And spoiler, that has now been enjoined, right? That's the good news. So I'm going to tell you what they were trying to do. It is very clear to me why it was enjoined. And I do not think that this proposed rule is going to stand. So let's go through it. First, I think it's important to differentiate between immigration and asylum. And this is horrifying because I suppose reasonable people could have differing views on immigration into this country. Immigration is, as we've talked about on the show, the question of whether when you reside in the United States, you have been lawfully, quote, admitted, end quote, into the United States. That's the language that is used in the relevant section of the U.S. Code, 8 U.S.C. 1101. Now, as we've talked about, to our collective dismay, we talked about this since before Donald Trump was elected, the president has wide discretion with respect to immigration policy as a result of numerous laws that Congress has passed over the years. And those laws delegate to the president, to other executive agencies, broad discretion as to when individuals may be ineligible to receive visas and thus become otherwise ineligible to be admitted into the United States, right? That is 8 U.S.C. 1152, which permitted the Muslim ban, and 1182. Asylum is not immigration. It is distinct from being admitted into the United States. It is the question, and the definition of asylum for eligibility, this comes straight from the Immigration and Nationality Act, is any alien who is physically present in the United States, irrespective of their status, may apply for asylum. Okay, so you do not have to be legally admitted into this country. You set foot on U.S. soil, and you can petition for asylum. And the reasons under which we grant asylum are when there is an imminent and severe risk of harm to the individual if they are returned to their country of origin, right? These are people fleeing oppression and violence, and asylum is a basic humanitarian concept that has been entrenched in international law for a century. It's what makes us not the bad guys, right?
Well, I mean, we're all the bad guys for probably causing a lot of the reasons people are seeking asylum, but sure, yeah.
Yeah, well, and look, like, this is, right, these are people who are subject to political persecution, right? These are the most heartbreaking humanitarian cases around the globe. Now, because of that, the laws permit the executive branch, in its discretion, to provide protection to aliens who meet the international definition of refugees, right? And I just talked about what that standard is. That is, the key word there is discretion. And because it is an executive branch decision, that is left to the discretion of the Attorney General. So when you elect a monster like Donald Trump and he appoints hacks like Bill Barr, you are going to get the most extreme definitions possible. We have talked about this on the show. Barr's predecessor, Jeff Sessions, changed the internal guidelines at the DOJ for asylum status and eliminated and, I should say, severely curtailed women facing domestic abuse when such abuse was systematic, right? Like fleeing in countries that conduct honor killings, right? Like, you know, it fleeing from gang violence, from, you know, mass rape, like just horrible stuff. And they restricted out that interpretation as not, in their opinion, meeting the standard for the international classification of refugee. It is demonstrably wrong, but it is nevertheless within their discretion. And as we said on the show, there was pretty much nothing you could do about it. But this proposed regulation went even further than that. Here's what the Trump administration did a little over a week ago. They made a new rule that bars asylum eligibility, quote, for aliens who enter or attempt to enter the United States across the southern border after failing to apply for protection from persecution or torture in at least one third country through which they transited en route to the United States. So what that means is, if you enter the United States at the southern border and you did not first apply for asylum in Mexico or some other Latin American country, you are categorically barred from asylum, even if you're leaving Mexico, right? Even if that's the harm, right? You're fleeing gangs in Mexico, right? It would say, oh, sorry, you could have petitioned to be somewhere else, and you didn't, you came into the United States, and so we're going to say categorically this now becomes sort of the equivalent of the non-justiciable question, right? Like, we're going to say, we don't even inquire into your circumstance. It could be terrible. It could be the worst possible situation. It could meet all the definitions for asylum. You're not eligible for asylum if you didn't try and go somewhere else first. So that's what they did. And also, they did it immediately. And many of our sharp listeners commented on our social media of, hey, look, I thought that when an administrative agency makes a new rule, they have to go through a notice and comment period. Right you are, except that the APA has exemptions. You ordinarily are subject to public notice and comment, except for the two exemptions that were invoked here. 5 U.S.C. 553A1 for a military or foreign affairs function of the United States, or the catch-all 553B3B, when the agency for good cause finds that notice and public procedure thereon are impracticable, unnecessary, or contrary to the public interest. So not only did they change the rule, not only is it horrifying, but they did so immediately without any notice or comment period because reasons.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by Policy Genius. You know, these days, a lot of workplaces offer some pretty nice perks, a snack station, 15 flavors of soda water, even insurance. But while it's nice to have a handful of trail mix and some water that tastes faintly of pamplemousse, that's not enough to subsist on, and neither is your workplace life insurance. That is where Policy Genius comes in. Policy Genius is an easy way to shop for life insurance online. In minutes, you can compare quotes from top insurers and find the right amount of coverage that is at the best possible price. The Policy Genius team can look over your workplace life insurance policy and help you decide what else you might need and what you don't. And Policy Genius doesn't just make life insurance easy, they also help you find the right home insurance, auto insurance, and disability insurance. So remember, workplace life insurance policies are like workplace snacks. They're better than nothing, but they're not quite enough. Head to policygenius.com today and find out how to supplement your workplace life insurance and better protect your family. Policy Genius. It's like a buffet made of life insurance. And what could be more delicious than that? Yeah, is this going to be another case of where we're only saved by incompetence and because they try to be absolutely unreasonable in how they do something like this? And therefore, that's or is this a case where what they're doing is just on its face, you know, not constitutional or something? Which of those two scenarios is it going to be?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And it turns out that it's both here. Right. So the evading the notice and comment period, I don't know why they did that. Right. Because at the end of the day, like they could have just promulgated, you know, they could have posted the rule, sought notice and comment like they did with the FCC overturning the fairness doctrine. It would have caused the same level of outcry would have still energized the base. And then in 30 days, they would have been like, now we're putting into use. Here's why I think they didn't do it. Okay. Because the reason that they care about asylum claims is not, I think, it's hard to get inside the mind of somebody who wants to put people in camps. But I don't think it is because they care about asylum. I think they care about the fact that you can raise a claim for asylum as a defense in expedited removal proceedings. And there are so many of those that
they're trying to do
now,
the raids.
I'm sorry?
And they're trying to do some raids. Is that what it is?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. So, let's talk a little bit about expedited removal proceedings. Those are, as opposed to full removal proceedings, the expedited ones apply whenever CBP determines that a non-citizen arriving at a port of entry is inadmissible for misrepresenting a material fact or lacking necessary documentation. And that authority applies to non-citizens arrested within 100 miles of the border and unable to prove that they have been in the U.S. for more than the last 2 weeks. At the same time, and this is being challenged separately, but as far as I know is still in effect, the DHS published a notice that it was going to expand that to be aliens anywhere in the U.S. for up to 2 years after you arrived in the U.S. We'll see the fate of that particular regulation, but interpretation. But if you fall within that category, you're at the border, you lack documentation, you can't prove you've been in the U.S. for more than the last 2 weeks, you shall be removed from the U.S. without further hearing or review unless you indicate an intention to apply for asylum or you have a legitimate fear of persecution in your home country. Fear of persecution just means you then get the court process, right? And I'm going to talk about the court process. You might even put scare quotes around it in a second. But I want to be clear, unless you apply for asylum or you demonstrate a credible fear of persecution, the government can just summarily remove you. That's what expedited proceedings mean. There is virtually nothing in the way of due process. This is what's going on right now. This is part of what's terrifying. And I'm not going to go through, don't think we have time, what the credible fear of persecution is, but it's a high bar to cross. But suppose you do. Suppose you cross it and you apply for asylum. That doesn't mean you go to the U.S. District Court for the district, you know, Southern District of Texas or what have you. You go before an immigration judge. And I'm going to link a really, really compelling article. Somebody I've reached out to want to come on the show. Her name is Dana Lee Marks. She has been an immigration judge for 20 years. And she wrote an article for The Washington Post about a month and a half ago for The Washington Post explaining what an immigration judge is. And let me kind of put some legal gloss on top of that, but then also give you some of her advice from the trenches. A U.S. District Court judge, all the judges that we talk about, Supreme Court judges, judges on the circuit courts of appeal, they are Article III judges. That comes from Article III of the Constitution, right, which creates the judiciary. An immigration judge is a rare subset. We've only referred to this tangentially on the show of what are called Article I judges, right? And as you think about that, right, Article I is Congress. And Congress can, when it delegates rulemaking authority to an executive agency, can also authorize the creation of, quote, judges to adjudicate disputes that arise under that authority. And so the crucial thing here is an administrative court, an immigration judge is sitting in an immigration court that is an administrative court. They are part of the Justice Department. They are not part of the judicial branch. So they are executive branch appointees. They report to Bill Barr, right? They are governed by political appointees. And because they have a limited congressionally approved range of authority, they lack the inherent equitable powers that a court has, right? So we talk about this on the show all the time, how, you know, your crazy technicality isn't going to fly in court because a judge can just be like, that's great that you signed the form in triplicate and jumped through the hoops and put the proper pieces of the puzzle, but like, this isn't fair, so I'm not going to do it. An Article I judge does not have that power. If you don't comply with the technical requirements, they are required by statute to follow whatever the statute says, which is usually deport you to your country of origin. They cannot make exceptions in hardship cases. That's part of what is so horrifying that's going on right now. If these were ordinary courts, you would say, you would expect that some judges would be exercising humanity and restraint. They don't have that. Gets worse. Most of the immigration laws, even minor ones, do not have statutes of limitation. So you can be in this country on an expired student visa for 20 years and you can be deported for a minor conviction, right? Even if the underlying crime is no longer enforceable because the immigration crime does not have a statute of limitations on it. That seems unfair. You're sighing, gets worse. People in immigration court proceedings, because they're Article I proceedings, do not have a Gideon right to court-appointed counsel.
Wow.
They don't have this even if they're minors. They don't have a right even if they don't speak English. And almost all of them don't speak English. It truly is a situation where it's almost impossible to imagine how you can effectively represent yourself in this. You want to know the ways it gets worse?
I thought this was a good news segment.
It will be. This, trust me, it will. I'm explaining how bad.
We're all
going
to be dead by the time you get to the good news part.
Yeah, I'm explaining how bad our immigration system is because I think it's really, really important to know that against the backdrop that when you have folks talking about, you know, being tough on crime and illegals and this and that, you are already talking about an environment in which people don't have the basics of due process. So in October of 2018, the then Jeff Sessions led Department of Justice ordered all immigration law judges to complete at least 700 cases per year. That is, remove them from their docket, or they would be graded with an unsatisfactory performance evaluation and subject to termination. So your instructions come from a political agency are to get rid of these cases as quickly as possible. And as Judge Marks points out, some of our judges, this is a quote, carry caseloads of 5,000 cases or more. Because we work for the Justice Department, we are directed how to arrange our dockets and micromanaged about how much time we spend on cases. So, all of that is, that's what you get if you petition for asylum or if you have a credible and demonstrable fear of persecution. And that's that minimal fig leaf of less than due process is what the Trump administration passed this regulation to take away, right? They want to say categorically to all of these refugees, to all of the persons that are within the purview and jurisdiction of ICE, they want to say, oh no, we've got a simple rule that's going to prevent you from raising your asylum claims. And if you can't raise your asylum claims, you can't get out of the expedited removal process. And we can deport you from the country without any due process whatsoever. That's why they promulgated that rule. That's why they care. They don't really care about asylum. They don't really care that this is going to hurt some legitimate asylum seekers. They care about forcibly removing tens, hundreds of thousands of people at the border where we've seen them make demonstrable mistakes. We've seen them detain actual U.S. citizens. They want to eliminate the minimal level of oversight that we have by being able to invoke a full hearing by petitioning for asylum. So I went through the terrible part, the good part. The court enjoined this. This was a district court in the Northern District of California. This is going to stand. It is very, very clear that both procedurally that the Trump administration had no legitimate grounds for evading the notice and comment period, but substantively that they had no authority to promulgate the total evisceration of asylum seeking in the United States. And again, remember, this is a preliminary injunction. So this is a determination of whether they have a substantial likelihood of success on the merits. This is not actually the merits determination, but right, the court says under our laws, the right to determine whether a particular group of applicants is categorically barred from eligibility for asylum is conferred on Congress. Congress has only empowered the Attorney General to establish additional limitations by regulation if such regulations are, quote, consistent with the existing immigration laws passed by Congress, end of quote. And this isn't. This is plainly, blatantly inconsistent with the congressional immigration laws. Congress is not, obviously now, thankfully, to the 2018 midterms, Congress is not going to pass a law making it easier to deprive people at the border of even a fig leaf of due process. So I think this is going to stand. And I think the decision, again, this is another lengthy decision. It's well reasoned. And I think it's going to stand up. But this is where the battleground is now, and it's really, really important, I think, that people know on all fronts what the Trump administration is trying to do. We've talked about the conditions, we've talked about everything surrounding the treatment, the separation of families at the border. But sometimes, I mean, one of the things that we try and touch on this show is the underlying structural conditions. And what the Trump administration wanted to do was essentially convert everybody at the border to an expedited removal process that has no meaningful oversight, no checks and balances, and nothing approaching due process. And we were able to stand up for that. So that is good news. It's bad news that we live in a terrible country right now, but it's good news.
And there's
that,
just so much to fix. You know, this is why Negatron speaking here. Maybe we get all three branches, and maybe we get Congress and the presidency and fix one to two things, and then white people in the country get really mad, and in 2022 we lose again, like happened in 2010. But like, there's so much to fix. We have to keep our energy up for a long time, everybody. We really do. We have to win in 2020, and we have to keep the energy up, even if things don't instantly magically go back to perfect or back. I say back. They were never. Even if things don't instantly magically get fixed, there's so much to do. We have to keep our energy up. We have to keep enthusiasm up, and it's sustained. Democratic control is the only way we're going to fix so many of these things that are broken.
I couldn't agree more. I think you said it really, really well.
Gee, Zachary Terwilliger, what a clown horn of a week. Oh, wow. Well, we are very low on time, but I know you have a few more things you wanted to get to. What do you think you can lightning round?
All right. I'll lightning round two things and then we'll be done. So, just one sentence, man, I could go another hour and a half on the literally today as we record the settlement between the Federal Trade Commission and Facebook, under which Facebook agrees to revise its privacy policies and pay $5 billion. That's orders of magnitude higher than any prior consumer protection settlement that the FTC has ever imposed. There's so much to talk about there, but we're going to have to do that in another show. I'm really, really excited. I want to talk to you all about it. Number two, and I you got to give me at least a minute on this one.
All right, lightning minute.
The District of Columbia Court of Appeals. This is the Board of Professional Responsibility, which are lawyers who volunteer, who then prepare a report for the court. DC Court of Appeals is the state Supreme Court in the District of Columbia. It is a court in front of which I have argued on several occasions. So this report is a report of lawyers. It has to be approved by the actual court, but it almost always is, right? I can't come up with attorney grievance cases in which the Court of Appeals, typically rewrites the fact finding. So, I have friends who do this in Maryland. I was actually asked to serve on this a couple of years ago on the Attorney Grievance Commission. And, and what you do is you review cases and then you prepare your report. This is a 183-page report on our good friend Larry Klayman and, professional crazy person. It is a recommendation that he be suspended from the practice of law for 33 months, for 3 years, almost 3 years, and then need to pass a fitness exam before he can be requalified to practice law in the District of Columbia. That's not nearly long enough, but hey, that's 3 years of us not having Larry Klayman filings. So that's a good thing. People ask all the time, is this going to get X person disbarred? And And my answer usually to that is no, right? And the Larry Klayman case is a good example. This is a person, if you disbarred people because they were jerks who abuse the legal system, Larry Klayman would be disbarred in every state of the union and possibly put in prison, right? Like, I mean, it's just, you know, he's a troll. This case even has a financial mismanagement component in the form of failure to get engagement letters and retainer letters with his client. But really what it is it's about a client who, you might question her judgment in going to Larry Klayman in the first case, but there's a woman named Elam Sataki. She was a journalist at The Voice of America. She alleged that she was sexually harassed by her co-host. Larry Klayman was a friend of hers who became obsessed. There's a whole lot of weird stuff about that in there. But basically, she went to Larry and said, "Hey, I need you to represent me in this case." Larry Klayman, after doing some Googling, realized that Hillary Clinton is on the board. Like the advisory board of the Voice of America. And so, you know, turned her case into this circus and named Hillary Clinton and blogged about it. And, you know, and she wrote over and over again, like, dude, ixnay with the Hillary Clinton stuff. Like, I have a straightforward claim of sexual harassment against my co-host. Can you please bring that? And he was like, yep, absolutely. And then blogged about it some more. And then as the capper, the case was first assigned to a different judge, but then was reassigned. We actually talked about this on Suspect in A Lot of Awful Movies, was reassigned, from docket management to Judge Colleen Kolar-Catelli, who we've talked about before. She is a distinguished jurist, but she's also ruled against Larry Klayman on a bunch of nonsense lawsuits. So he like in his demented mind, you know, conspiracy theory mind, like she's bought and paid for by the Clintons. And oh, yeah, now that I added the Clintons, you know, they switched it over to her pocket judge. And, you know, so he filed an incredibly stupid motion to disqualify Judge Kolar-Catelli. And this might not be a bad time, you know, to run that, like the Simpsons clip of Lionel Hutz being like, "Oh, we drew Judge Sanders. Like, he's had it ever since I accidentally ran over his dog." And by accidentally, I mean repeatedly. And by dog, I mean son. That is the relationship and the argument of Larry Klayman to Judge Kolar-Catelli. So he filed this unbelievably stupid motion to have her recuse herself. And she was like, "I'm a judge and you're an idiot, so I'm going to keep this case." And needless to say, like, all of this didn't really go very well for poor Ms. Sataki's claims. And ultimately, she filed an attorney grievance complaint that led to this. And now this is the conclusion of that process. The court is going to adopt these findings, and Larry Klayman is going to be suspended from the practice of law for a couple of years. So that's good news.
Wow. And time. All right. Your minute is over.
All right. I feel like that was 58 seconds, right?
Yeah. You just barely squeezed it in there. Should I not go to Larry Klayman for my complaint of bar exam harassment against my co-host?
I almost interrupted you at "should I not go to Larry Klayman?"
Yeah. So I should go to somebody else.
You should definitely find
at least for
else.
3 years or whatever.
Yeah. I think we have lawyers out there who'd be willing to represent you.
Yeah, pro bono. Speaking of bar exam harassment, Well, we're going to get to that, but we first, of course, have to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. Hope you're enjoying all the goodies. Hope you're enjoying potentially the bonus episode we may do. There's always good stuff. We've released a ton of bonus stuff lately. And discounts on the live show tickets, all that good stuff. Thank you to Mason Medeiros, Kathleen Chambers, E.G. Schimpf. Help us find the Minerva Park, Ohio howler monkey. Huh. Todd Christensen, Tosin, Carolus Ramaniscus, Kleber Mori. I think the Minnesota Timberwolves will win a championship. Yeah. J.D., Matt Mulder, and Jensen, Emerson Hammonds, Mary Basu, and Preston Mickelson. Your turn, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you to Rab, to Crush the Bar, Sweet Sauce, All My Love, Your Chicken Wing. That is such a sweet message.
That to me.
And Sweet Sauce, I hope you do crush the bar, because thing this world needs is more lawyers. Catharthus, DTJ's legal team. Justin Dossi, Yodel Mountain is my favorite segment. Siddler Davis, Brian, Ian Parmley, Tim Turner, Mr. Melkor, Natalie Simard, Paul McGowan, and this is a fantastic name, Ricardo Lovehammer, MD.
I love it. Great name.
I really want that to be his real name, because I just want to go to Dr. Lovehammer. So,
good times. All right, and now it's time for some presidential harassment. Or bar exam harassment. T3BE. Here we go.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
Yeah, T3BE. Here we go. So this was a mom whose adult son was a law school graduate. The mom hired a tutor and said, hey, you know, if my son passes the bar exam, he's going to make the sweet, sweet lawyer money, 55 grand, baby. And the tutor says, okay, I will give him a bar exam prep for 5,000. Before any money changes hands, he backed out. Getting a replacement would have cost them 6,000. But they didn't do that. They didn't do anything. Son then fails the bar exam. Law firm says, like we give 55 bills to, you know, anybody. No. You know, come back when you pass. And this is the hardest part of the lawsuit. But, you know, they do this kind of stuff on bar exam questions all the time. Quote, it can be shown that had the son received the tutor's instruction, he would have passed the bar exam. You know. Grant that for purposes of the discussion, because that would be a really hard thing to prove.
Yeah, it would.
So, mother and son jointly join as plaintiffs, sue the tutor for breach of contract. How much are they entitled to recover? There were four potential answers. A, $1,000, right? That's the difference between what they would have had to have paid to hire a tutor and what they could have paid this guy. B, $55,000, that's the full consequential damages of what happened as a result of the breach. C, nominal damages only, that is damages nominal, meaning in name only. So that's like you get a dollar, right? It says you win, you are vindicated, but you didn't suffer any harm because, you know, of whatever reason. And in this case, it was because the mother was not injured by the breach and the tutor made no promise to the son. Or D, nothing, because neither the mother nor the son took steps to avoid the consequences of the tutor's breach. First off, you eliminated full consequential damages of B. That's correct, right? And that is at minimum, you've got a duty to mitigate your damages. Failure to mitigate your damages always defeats any kind of claim for consequential damages.
Well, plus, and if you think about that one logically, why would it be a year's salary? Like, why not a lifetime salary or a half a year salary?
Yeah, no, that's right, too. But look, like, the reason in which you have consequential damages is in general, and this is a good principle to think of in breach of contract cases, right? Breach of contract is meant to fulfill the expectation of the parties and to render the breaching party, the party against whom the contract was breached, in as good a position as they would have been had the breaching party performed the contract. You don't use breach of contract to deter or to send a message or to express moral approbation or anything like that. But you do want to have the possibility, right? Consider an unlikely construction scenario, right, in which the contractor fails to install, you know, the last beam as required by the contract, and then the whole house collapses. Now, you'd probably would also have a negligence claim, but you'd want to preserve the right to say, you know, you wouldn't want the contractor to come in and be like, oh, yeah, I didn't install this piece of wood. Here you go, $1.38, right? You'd be like, my house fell down.
Yeah.
And if you'd have put the beam in, my house wouldn't have fallen down. But on the other hand, right, in light of the principles I've just described, you want to require plaintiffs to mitigate damages, right? You don't want a situation to be bad and for the plaintiff to be like, well, this is bad. Gosh, sure hope my house doesn't fall down.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, and then thereby shift too much back on the breaching party, because we, again, we have this idea of efficient theory of breach. So you ruled out B, good elimination. You were then choosing between C and D, between essentially $0 and $1, eliminating out A, the difference between.
My thinking there was like, they didn't pay anybody else for the thing, so why would they get $1,000? You know, like, wouldn't you have to hire somebody for $6,000 and then say you owe me the difference?
So you might think that, except that it is always permissible as a measure of damages to recover the difference between the contract price and the market price. Yeah. So as it turns out, A is actually in fact A. The correct answer.
Crazy.
The reason, so let's briefly explain C and D. And look, I said this when you were going through the question, all of these, right? B is the worst answer.
Yeah.
But all of these have a level of plausibility to them that, and we've seen this already, that that the answers that have come in have been kind of all over the map. The reason why D is an incorrect answer, right? Neither of the mother nor the son took steps to avoid the consequences of the breach. So that is, they failed to mitigate their damages. So that means they can't claim consequential damages, but you just have to know the rule of you can claim the difference between the contract price and the market price. And that's kind of like an opportunity loss.
Yeah. Yeah. So it doesn't matter that it was payment, doesn't matter starting it. None of that matters. It's just you've, I guess, signed a contract, and that's the magic part.
So think about it this way, right? Like, if you take it out of, I think this is a really cleverly worded question, but if you put it in a different context that asks the same principle, suppose, you know, I hire you to paint my fence, right? Mm-hmm. And I know the going rate is $200, and you promise to do it for $100, then you realize after signing the contract, oh man, like I could get $200 instead. I'm going to break that contract. I'm going to go get my $200 from somebody else. I don't have to pay somebody to actually paint my fence to then come back and be like, no, wait, dude, like we had a deal. You were going to do it. So I demand compensation for the fact that you had agreed to do it.
I thought you had to take any sort of steps to do. Yeah. So is it just different when it's like the landlord situation that we've talked about?
Yeah, because those are not breach of contract cases. This is just pure breach of contract. Yeah,
it is. When you sign a lease, right, how's it different?
Well, yes, but
you sign a lease for 6 months. You want to get out of it after 4 months. We've talked about this. The landlord can't just be like, well, you owe me 2 months. They have to try to fill the spot. So is it just different when it's landlord law?
Well, and again, that's not always true, right? That is true in jurisdictions that impose upon landlord a duty to mitigate damages. It's one of the reasons why I always refuse to answer hypothetical questions about landlord-tenant law at OA meetups and live shows and things like that, because it really does vary by jurisdiction. Generally speaking, if you live in a densely packed area with homeless issues, you can understand, right, the social reasons why you would require a landlord to mitigate damages. But not all jurisdictions require that.
I guess the lawyerly way of saying this is at common law or whatever.
Exactly.
You don't have to make any effort to mitigate anything. You just get the difference between market value. But you do have to make an effort in order to be able to have any claim toward consequential damages.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
All right. Well, you know, it was nice to get one flat out wrong. I'm glad, man, it sucks I didn't just go with my initial A. I still had the right answer, changed it.
I know.
The streak continues.
The streak does continue. Oh, the other thing on C is that the fact that it's the mother bringing the lawsuit doesn't mean that the mother and son can't jointly sue, because the son is a is an intended beneficiary of the contract.
Okay, yeah, you can
always bring a lawsuit on behalf of a contract that you signed to benefit someone else. Think about this, super easy. Like, you hire somebody to bring baby Phoebe no longer baby anymore, right?
It's baby Arlo.
Baby Arlo. But I was thinking little Phoebe. I was thinking bouncy castle, right? Hire someone to bring out a bouncy castle for Phoebe's birthday.
Arlo's not doing diddly clown horn in a bouncy castle.
Yeah, well, he might do something in a bouncy castle.
No, he would just wobble over. You know that blob you see on the, you know that weird animal? What is that? It's just a blobfish or something? Like, it would be, that's what he's like. Just a blob.
Anyway, the person doesn't show up with the bouncy castle. Even though it's Phoebe that has suffered the injury, you get to sue the bouncy castle manufacturer or bouncy castle
distributor. That's important going forward. I need to remember all this stuff. I learned a lot on this question. There's a lot of moving parts.
It's a really, really good question.
Boy, do I sure suck at the bar. What is my percentage now?
It's 55%. It's 75 for 136. You just need a little bit of a win streak and you can turn this back around. I know.
I don't know what's happened to me.
It's the dog days of summer are getting to you. You need a little bit of R&R.
Less. No. Yep. Same amount of studying, actually, so it's not that. No, all right. Well, there you go. Let's hop in our time machine and find out who the big winner of this week's T3BE is.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, lots of people this week agreed with you and picked D. In fact, multiple people sent the Willy Wonka, you get nothing gif. But as you know, the correct answer was A. I liked a bunch of different A answers, but I think I'm going to go with John Mellon here, who says, A, second week in a row that I agree with original Thomas and not overthinking Thomas. Mother injured by breach because she contracted to get the tutor, so clearly valued it. And not taking reasonable steps to avoid damages only prevents claiming damages you could have avoided. Really succinct. Absolutely correct. Congratulations, John Mellon. Everyone, give him a follow. That is at JON_MELLON. John Mellon on Twitter. Congratulations on being this week's winner.
All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Andrew, for doing a full Friday-sized episode in a Tuesday frame. Just bursting with content this week. But that's okay. They deserve it. The people deserve it. And we will see you for probably rapid response, or maybe patrons will see us sooner. We'll see.
Who knows?
See you either time.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.